living some little men and women. They are our past. And maybe, maybe they are our future.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Inside Out with Tyra St. John. You're listening to KPFZ 88.1. There's a stunning sun here in Lake County today, and we have a sun with us, an S-U-N with us, a very wise and bright man named Thomas Moore, who was on the show about a year ago, and we're so lucky to have him back. Are you there, Thomas?
I'm here.
Thank you so much for being with us again. You are mainly a writer, but you're also a therapist, or I guess you were, right?
Yes, I was a therapist for about 30 years, and I still do a tiny bit of therapy, but mainly write and travel now.
But you're not exactly a Jungian. This is a Carl Jung series, so I definitely wanted you in this series. Could you tell us your connection with the Carl Jung thought?
Sure. When I was doing my PhD studies, I read Jung very intensely. I think I went through his collected works three times then. I mean, that's a big job. It's about 20 volumes. So I really immersed myself in Jung and was taught by people who knew Jung well. But shortly afterwards, I had an opportunity to study to be a Jungian analyst. I wanted a little more freedom. I wanted to move beyond just what is, you know, contained in Jung's work. I'd like to be more eclectic. So I continue to study Jung closely. I lecture at Jung societies very frequently. But I chose not to be a Jungian analyst.
That's so interesting. I would have given my eye teeth to be a Jungian analyst, but I wasn't able to do that at the time. Now I'm trying to figure out a way to do it.
I see. Well, it's all relative.
Right. And it's also in the heart and mind. It doesn't have to be, we don't have to go to Switzerland necessarily or to San Francisco or L.A. to understand the process, some of the processes of Carl Jung and some of the depth psychology that we use in all ways with people. You wrote the book, Care of the Soul, that we were related to last year, and I think you're working on another book, or is it out?
Well, I'm always working on several, so it's a little complicated. I have a book on the Gospels coming out in about a month.
Okay. What will be the title of that?
It's called Writing in the Sand.
Mm.
It's from one of the Gospel stories when Jesus writes in the sand.
Are you able to tell us which one, or is that a secret?
Which story?
Yes.
Oh, it's a story where a woman has been accused of adultery and is about to be punished, I mean, maybe killed for it. And he comes in and asks for who among the people about to condemn her have not done anything wrong themselves, and there's silence, and he starts writing in the sand, or writing in the ground. And what I like that story because I think Jesus' followers tend to, I'm afraid, keep the moralism in it, and he doesn't show that. So I like that story for that purpose. But also the idea of writing in the ground or in the earth or in the sand indicates, it's like a Buddhist notion that where you say something, but you don't remain attached to it. You allow it to disappear with the wind.
Oh, I like that so much. We have so much of that in us where we want to kind of remain with a thought or an idea rather
That's
than
right.
letting it go.
That's right,
and
which is another reason why I'm not a Jungian, if you
right.
see what I mean.
Right. Well, there's a song in the Agape Church, which you probably are familiar with in Los Angeles, with Reverend Michael Beckwith.
Yes.
Have you ever come across him?
Yes.
It's I Release and I Let Go.
Mm.
I don't dare sing on the radio or they will shut me off. But it's a wonderful song, and it's sung in a group, and it's a very lively song. You know, I release and I let go. And it's just a reminder again and again of releasing
right.
thought, releasing people, being detached, but not detached without love. It is, the love is always there.
Yes.
Right.
That's exactly what I mean by it.
Right. So writing in the sand, I can't
mm-hmm.
wait, I can't wait.
Go ahead.
So I'm looking forward to that. And the next one, what are some of the others?
Well, the next book I'm just about finished with, I don't know what it's going to be called now. I was going to call it The Soul of Medicine, but I understand that that title has been taken recently, so I have to work that again. But it's about the soul of medicine. It's about trying to bring a more humane a deeper approach to our hospitals and to our health care industry. So it's and also I try to help patients in this book, those of us who are patients in the health industry, to be able to keep our souls as we go through the process.
Oh, I think that's fabulous. I have a doctor coming on at 2 o'clock who's a dermatologist on my, I have two shows, and one of them is called It's Your Business. And he's coming on as a dermatologist because that's what he does. And he's also very, very active in the alternative medicine field. He's a surgeon. He does surgery on cancer. And he's a very bright young man. And whether you'd ever want to talk with him or not, but he's an interesting person.
That sounds excellent.
We'll see how he's going to do. We were going to talk today. Oh, now the solar medicine. Let's go on with your books that you've written, that you're in the process of writing.
Yes. Well, I've got another one written and it's just waiting in line to get published. And this is a departure for me. It's a collection of short stories.
Oh.
And each of the stories takes place on a golf course.
Oh, wow. Are you a golfer?
Well, I did take up golf after I had some heart problems. It keeps me out and walking with some interest. And
right.
So I wouldn't say that I'm certainly not a fanatical golf player, but I do play. I have a golf course right across the street from me, so I play there in the summer quite often.
Oh, that's great. You don't break clubs over your knee then.
I don't.
Well, I can't wait to see those too. That's and it's fun and interesting and creative to go into a different medium.
I love fiction. I love to write fiction. Uh-huh. It's so easy compared to in a certain way compared to writing these heavy books.
Right.
But on the other hand, it's difficult because you have to get the story just right. And,
right.
You know, that has to come to you. You can't manufacture it.
And where do you publish your books?
Well, I've been moving around lately. I started out publishing most of my books with HarperCollins. And then I moved around a bit to two other publishers, and now I'm with Hay House Publishing. And
right.
They're doing these three books that I've mentioned.
Mm. They have wonderful books. I have some of her books.
Mm-hmm.
So are there others that we need to know about?
No, I think that will cover it for right now. It's keeping me busy.
But you did edit Dr. Hillman's book, the new one, fairly new.
Blue Fire. Well, that was quite a few years ago, but
Is that old?
Yeah, that was quite a while ago. I can't remember when that came out, but it was it must be 10 years.
Okay.
But that book is, you know, lasting. I think it's something that will last a while, and that was quite difficult actually. You know, more difficult than writing my own books to put his words together and edit them and introduce them and make them easier to understand by the average reader.
Right. Uh huh. Well, I thought it was a new book because I just bought it last year, probably.
Well, good. That's what I like. You know, buy the books and
right.
Consider them new. That's what it should be.
So I'm sure there's a whole section on you in Amazon.
Yes.
If anyone wants to Google Thomas More, some of your great books. I know Care of the Soul is next to my heart, as well as next to my bed.
Well, great.
And I love that book. And some of the others in the past that you've written, I know you've written about marriage.
I wrote a book called Soulmates, which is about the soul dimension of relationship.
Right.
And so that was right after Care of the Soul. And yes, I wrote a book, The Soul of Sex, which is also related to marriage. I tried to get to the non-biological, the more human dimensions of sexuality.
Right.
I wrote a book on religion called The Soul's Religion, where I really tried to tackle the spiritual life and religious experience from the soul point of view, which I understand to be the deeper, more that Jungian soul, you know, the deeper soul.
Right.
The most recent book I put out was called, there's one called Dark Nights of the Soul that a lot of people read, which is really, I think that book is one of the best that came out recently, Dark Nights of the Soul.
Is that your book?
Yes. It's based generally on the idea of Dark Night of the Soul, 16th century book by John of the Cross, who was a mystic.
Right.
But it is what I'm doing is sort of taking the idea but applying it to anyone's experience of going through a tunnel experience or a dark night and not only depression, but maybe like going through an illness or a divorce or a loss of job, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like my last year.
Well, it sounds like many of mine, that's for sure.
Right. I didn't realize you had written that book somehow. I missed that one.
Yeah.
That would be very important for me to read. And you've read the John of the Cross books, I guess.
Oh, yes.
The Dark Night of the Soul.
Yes.
Right. Well, we were going to talk today about healing ourselves, body, soul, and spirit. And that is a big order, isn't it?
It is. It's a huge order.
That's a lifetime task, we might say, or a lifetime joy, I don't know which. How would we start with that, about healing, or would we start with body, or working on ourselves? What do you think would be a good...
Well, I think the starting point, if you know, my focus of all my books is this idea of soul, and it maybe wouldn't hurt to say something about that, because the word is used in so many different ways.
I would like to do that. Go ahead.
I understand the soul to be that which makes us human beings and makes us individual. I mean, this is not my idea. These are very old ideas about what the soul is. Aristotle said that the soul is what makes a thing exactly what it is. Jung developed this notion that the soul is largely unconscious to us, so it's that unconscious life, what appears in our dreams and our fantasies and our fears and desires. So that our deep emotions and our very deep thoughts come from the soul, whereas the spirit tends to be more the part of us that wants to transcend and is visionary and ambitious and, it's part of our spiritual life. The spiritual life is different from the life of soul in that regard, even though they're very close to each other. Hmm. They're different. So when I talk about caring for the soul, I mean caring for our memories, our past, our fears, relationships, the sense of home, all these things that are very intimate and really related very much to our everyday life. So it's quite different from that very big cosmic notion of spirit. It's very intimate, close to home. And the word that we use over and over again that the Greeks used for the soul is deep, that it's the deep part of the human being, whereas the spirit tends to be the height, the high part.
That's interesting. I never had really separated them out in that way. In approaching our own souls, part of it is some of it that maybe we were taught if we were in very fundamental churches as youngsters, that we ought to deny ourselves, which is comfort. And it's kind of a funny juxtaposition there, isn't it?
It is. I think it's, sometimes not only the churches that, we grew up in, but religious and spiritual traditions around the world sometimes have this shadow quality, or they run into this difficulty that they recommend putting down the soul, what I'm calling the soul, in favor of the spirit. In other words, for example, when I was a kid, I left home to enter the Catholic seminary to be a priest. I left my family when I was 13. Well, today I wouldn't do that, because family is so important for the soul, for the depth of one's life and the tender feelings you have around family. I had a very wonderful family, and leaving it was really difficult and painful. And I was always told to forget about it, just forget about your family, go and, become a priest and all this. And now I look at that and I see, yes, that was that emphasis on the spiritual ambition that didn't take into account the importance of those soul needs like family and home.
Why did you do that? Did you think that that was what you were supposed to do?
I wanted to do what was the very best I could do in my life. I mean, I had a great ambition to do, to reach for the stars.
You wanted to soar.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to soar. And in the context of my life, with a very Catholic family and going to a Catholic school, it was just drilled into me that the best you could possibly be would be a priest.
Right.
Not only that, but I think it was more than that. I also was very attracted, as I have been all my life, to theology and spirituality. So I was an altar boy and hung around with priests, and I really loved what they were interested in, what they were doing, and I still do. And as many people have pointed out, I still do the work of a priest, even though I gave it up many, many years ago. I gave up that literal desire, but I still do it.
You're like a very highly spiritual street priest.
Right.
Or something like that. I'm not quite sure.
I don't know either. But
a very comfortable street priest.
Well, I'm a married person with a family and, trying to make my living. And so there's that side of it. But at the same time, I write these books. I give talks. I speak from pulpits all the time. I'm always being invited to speak in churches. So I've not given the life up completely, but it's in a very different form from what I expected it to be.
How far did you go with your theological training?
Well, I was in it for 13 years, and I was in it in two different dimensions. One was the seminary. That means to study to be a priest. I was also in a religious order, sort of a quasi-monastic order. So I lived pretty much the monastic life also. So those are really two different things. A person could be in a seminary and not be in the monastic thing at all. So I did those two things for 13 years, and I was about 6 months from ordination to the priesthood when I left.
Wow. That was a huge step for you, wasn't it?
It was a big step. It changed my life completely. But on the other hand, people often say it must have been a difficult decision, and in some ways it wasn't, because I just woke up one day and realized that whatever it was that brought me into it, it was satisfied, that I had no regrets at all about what I did. It was over.
It was over, and you were ready for the new
part of your life. I was ready for the next thing, that's right.
So it's part of that detachment, letting go.
It was a letting go, absolutely, a letting go. And I have to say, it wasn't all that difficult compared to other things I've had to do in my life.
And you were a, I'm trying to think of the name, the same as Boston University, I mean Boston College.
Catholic, yeah.
Well, it's Catholic. The order is...
The order I was in, no. The order I was in was a very small order called Servites.
Okay.
A very wonderful group of people, an excellent order to be in, because they really prized education, and also they were not terribly, they liked the good life too, you know, that's what I liked about it. They liked to enjoy life. It wasn't an ascetic kind of life-denying kind of group at all.
What kind of, where were you in that, what part of the United States?
I was mainly Chicago. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of Servite communities even now in California, but I was mainly in Chicago. I did spend a couple of years in Northern Ireland in my studies, and I still have a very strong connection to Ireland, but mainly it was Chicago.
Are you Irish?
My family is Irish. Mm-hmm. My grandparents and that sort of thing, but I was born here.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, I'm just thinking about that huge change in your life and how you were kind of guided both into it and out of it, the same spirit that guided you into it, guided you out for other kinds of work, which is more, in a strange way, almost more universal, where there are more people who could be reached and more people who could be. Not that you were necessarily thinking of yourself as a teacher, I don't know. You know, you have a larger realm.
A bigger audience
that you can reach this way.
That's certainly true. And you know, it's interesting that you say that. My family, some of my family members, you know, it's difficult when you're in going to be a priest, and it's great. It's a great matter of pride for Catholic families to have a priest in the family.
Oh, sure.
But my family was very, very understanding of me and always told me to feel absolutely free if I ever, you know, felt like coming home.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember an aunt of mine once said that she thought that probably, you know, my vocation was to enter it and then leave it and then do what I have to do now. And I think, that makes sense, of course. It's what happened. But all my life, I have just followed the signs. I've not been able to stick to a straight line. If things have to change, I just move with that change, and for better or worse. And some people think it creates a kind of sloppy life, but for me, it makes sense.
Right. That's the way my life has been. I hate to say it, but it has been. I've moved something like 42 times, and moved, you know, gotten in a truck and gone from New York to L.A. and taken all my furniture with me and all that kind of thing, and not ever regretted it, really.
No.
It's been very, very, you know, great variety and wonderful people and wonderful things that happen, and a lot of difficulties along the way that were certainly lessons. But I hope the spirit of the Servites is over Lake County, because if they produced you somehow, if out of that environment came Thomas More, then I hope that will pervade our county today and many days.
Well, thank you.
They
are a wonderful group, and I unfortunately do not have much contact anymore with them. I have a little bit, but not much.
So from there, you did what?
Well, I've been interested in music all my life. I've studied music. I studied music composition, classical music, and so at first I thought, well, I'll become a musician, and I went to music school. went to the University of Michigan, which is an excellent music school.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out there that my interest in theology and philosophy and the spiritual realm are so strong. I combined them with my musical studies, but at that time, the university wasn't too much interested in my doing that. So since then, they've changed. You know, now I get phone calls from universities asking me to come and lecture about it.
Right.
But at the time, they said, well, we don't understand this, so, you know, goodbye.
Right.
So I went to got a degree in theology in Canada and then found that I could study religion at Syracuse University in the way that I wanted to. And it's true. They gave me free tuition and a living stipend and everything to study there. It was wonderful. And I got exactly what I needed. Syracuse in Syracuse, New York.
Oh, isn't that where one of the University of New York, what school was it?
I was at Syracuse University.
Oh, that has a fabulous music department. That's the one that's near. I'm trying to think. What else is in Syracuse?
Well, there is a state university
right
there. But I studied religion there at Syracuse and got my PhD in religious studies.
Oh, okay.
And that's what I'm saying. It was just what I wanted because I was able to study outside of a particular tradition, you know, and to study the arts and psychology in close relationship with religion, which is what I thought should be done. So it was a wonderful place for me to go.
Did you know Joseph Campbell?
I did, yeah, not really well, but yes, I had many conversations with him and was with him in a few different places. I didn't know him as well as some of my colleagues did,
mm-hmm.
but I did have a good chance to discuss things that I was very interested in and what he was doing, to discuss them with him and raise some of my problems with
it. Right, and the circles that you, of your life, and I don't mean people, I just mean the energies of your
mm-hmm.
life and his do cross over in a number of places,
yes.
Right?
Yes, very, mm-hmm. very much so. Very much so,
right.
Yeah.
So today, we're talking about body, soul, and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of covered a little bit of what the soul is, but how do we approach the body? That's another thing that we've been kind of prohibited from in certain religions is understanding and dealing with the body, and we kind of forget that we have a body until we get sick.
That's right.
And then so we don't understand the needs of the body. So how would you approach that?
Well, I would say that I wouldn't want to separate the body from the soul and the spirit. That's a big thing. That's
right.
A big part of my work. I think it's really necessary to keep the person together so that we don't break them up,
right.
break us up into these parts. So I think we have the sense sometimes that you go to a doctor and you bring your body parts to them to get repaired.
Right.
And, you know, it's a little bit like taking your car in. It's very similar. And some of the language used is similar, you know. And so I always want to suggest that we always come with our soul and spirit. So I've been visiting a great many hospitals and medical centers and medical schools over the past 10 years, and I've been invited. I didn't intend at first to do that, but I got invited to them. So I've seen what goes on, and in the education, especially of doctors and even nurses, there's so much technical education that a person comes out of medical school, generally speaking, not everybody, but generally speaking, with this technical, objective view of the body, that as though it has no relationship to emotion or to the mind or other relationships a person might have or their work or their families or their spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to bring all that back in very explicitly. And, you know, it's not going to happen for a long time, but I think someone's got to speak for it. Medical schools, I think, are getting much more interested. Many of them have programs in spirituality. And I don't think many of them, if any, really understand this thing about soul. I mean, they understand the spirit, bringing spirituality into them. So I feel like I have a lot of work to do there to try to bring all three of these pieces together.
There's a doctor by the name of Bruce Perry, you may know about him, who has childtrauma.com in Houston. It's a worldwide, he's a worldwide well-known neurologist. And
mm-hmm.
And psychiatrist, I believe, also, or psychologist. He treats children for trauma, and he talks, as you do, about a whole new paradigm in raising and treating children As does the ACE study. You may have seen that.
Yes, I have.
Dr. Folletti's group. It seems that as a culture, your types of writers and knowers who are leading this movement, you might say, toward holistic holistic selves, I guess you call it, I see it kind of like where we project ourselves on our screen of our own movies. You know, we are holistic people, holistic beings, and we project our lives and the, you know, out rather than it being projected in. I see it kind of like that. And the end result is the same because we project out what is on our inner life, our emotion, like you say, in mind and work and families. And I'm just so grateful to you that you are a thinker that way and that you write that way.
Well, thank you. There's nothing I can do, but, you know, you just do what you, where your imagination and your temperament is and where your education is. And I just have always liked putting things together rather than keeping them apart. And this is one area. I can tell you one thing, too. I've written about sexuality from this point of view, because I think that, along with what you were saying before, the spiritual life, spirituality sometimes becomes so aimed at perfection and at meditation and getting, having out-of-body experiences that sexuality becomes an obstacle, and eventually there can get some negative attitudes towards it. Or the opposite, which is, in a way, just as bad, sentimentalizing sexuality, making it almost too big. But I've tried to make this a part of my work, too, especially since I've seen in therapy so many people presenting sexual difficulties. So I think a good way to get to the body and the soul, to get them all together, is to for a person to get their sexuality in order, in a way, to feel more comfortable about their sexuality and about their sexual relationships and sexual history. That's why I wrote the book Soul of Sex, because I think it was so intimately connected to my project, my work of trying to connect body, soul, and spirit, body, soul, and spirit, right?
Right, and the sensuality of our lives is is often lost in the materiality of sex, so to speak.
Well, it's lost in either one of two directions, in the materiality of sex, which is certainly one direction, and all the emphasis on biology and unconsciousness. On the other side, it's lost in the ignoring sex in the spiritual realm, where you want to be above it, or you know, want perfection and purity to the point where sex is, you know, it can't be integrated.
Also, in understanding all the ways that sexuality is expressed today, which is coming very much more understood and accepted, which is sexual preference. And understanding children from a sexual preference point of view and that kind of thing. I think we're learning a lot that is extremely helpful.
It's expanding. You know, it's opening up. For a long while, our sense of what sex was and what it should be was very narrow. And we're being forced with a great deal of pain and difficulty, which is true of any kind of learning and movement, maturation. We are being forced, in a way, to open up and consider more possibilities. And I think that's really an important move, and it does show a growing up process.
Do I dare ask you about reincarnation, how you feel about the thoughts regarding reincarnation? For me, they are metaphysically throughout the Bible. I see things that have to do with people who are sort of coming back and, you know, Elijah and different people. And that it is a way, maybe, that spiritually we do come back and learn more lessons and that kind of thing. How does that fit with your...
It's funny, I was just meditating on that this morning on my walk. My wife is a teacher of Kundalini Yoga and just naturally thinks that reincarnation. I don't know. I just don't know. I'll tell you what I do. My approach myself, personally, is I really love mystery. I like to protect and maintain the mysterious parts of all of our experiences. And I certainly would not literally say, well, we're reincarnating. I like to keep it unknown. I prefer personally to be on the edge where I don't know about those things. I just leave it open. The fact that the religions have talked about reincarnation or about heaven and hell and things like that is something that I take very seriously. Not mm-hmm. necessarily literally, but seriously. So I do take reincarnation very seriously, and I don't know about it. I'm interested, but speaking about what is or what is not to the facts, I like to keep that mysterious. I prefer to talk about death and afterlife as mysteries and right. To honor those mysteries. You'll find that phrase in all my writing, honoring the mysteries. So that applies in this particular case. And I don't know, I just have not been able to, myself, temperamentally get a hold of reincarnation too intimately.
And honoring the mystery also means seeing the importance of now, of living in the moment, living today and living a full life right now, not really worrying too much about before or after something.
That's true. That's right. Certainly true. Right. Yeah, I don't subscribe to this here and now philosophy entirely. I'm a great believer in the past, and you know, and remaining attached to the past. I think past is wonderful. If anything, I live in the past. But on the other hand, I think you're right that not paying attention to the afterlife, and I really don't. I just keep it a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It does. I think it does get you your focus on who you are now with your life, your work, your friends and your family. The issues, the world issues around you, these become, I think, more important when you don't drift away into the future.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about soul, and we've mm-hmm. talked a little bit about body,
mm-hmm.
and we've talked a little bit about spirit, actually.
Yes.
And so healing ourselves, body, soul, and spirit, must be some centrality to all of this that we can approach not only through its various component, you might say, but through the wholeness of ourselves. And how do we do this?
Well, I think that there are, and this is a very traditional teaching, there are sicknesses of soul, sicknesses of spirit, and sicknesses of the body, and they are often related to each other, but they are distinct. So I think there are sicknesses of the spirit. People can believe naively. You know, like a lot of people, I think, believe what they were taught when they were children. I see this in therapy. A lot of people come with conflicts as adults, and we explore them, and we run up against beliefs that they have that they picked up as children, often from their parents and sometimes from a local religious or spiritual leader.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, a person may have a very naive notion of the spiritual issues, you know, a very naive notion of God and of damnation and guilt. And there may be a lot of guilt around a person's spiritual life because they were told to be perfect and they aren't supposed to be doing things that they can't help doing.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So, and beliefs that are just too naive. The believing in things without having any intelligence about them can lead a person to be very immature at the spiritual level. So there are sicknesses of the spirit, and I think that to talk about healing the spirit, at some level, it means dealing with some of those problems. So you have to look at your spiritual life and say, where is it? Is it maturing? Is it developing? Is it supple? Is it rigid? Is it hurting me? Is it hurting the rest of my life? Or is it actually nicely woven into the rest of things, other values that I have? And like people who have great struggles between science and religion, I think are there's a bit of a spiritual sickness there. You know, If there's some rigidity, so somehow we have to open and loosen up our approach to the spirit. But I think there are a lot of spiritual maladies that have to be addressed. And we don't think of it that way usually, but I think they're there. A negative attitude towards sexuality I see all over the place. Someone comes to me in therapy and they say they're unhappy with their sex life. I would say invariably we're going to run into some spiritual leader who taught them that sex is not good and they should try to avoid it, or
right.
you know, clench their teeth and just go through it, and you know, it's a necessity, but don't make anything of it and feel guilty. Well, I've just seen so many marriages suffer for that reason. That's a spiritual malady. That's a spiritual sickness.
Right. There seems to be, when people bring too much morality into human behavior rather than understanding of it. That's kind of fits your story of the woman where Christ was asking the others if they had done anything wrong.
Right, exactly.
When we go from too strong a moral posture, we kind of miss the boat of what the person is all about. We don't go deeply enough to find out where he or she is coming from or where we ourselves are coming from in terms of that behavior. We hate ourselves or we hate somebody else or we judge or criticize out of our more lack of understanding than what we're saying, the morality of it. I'm not saying
exactly. That, no, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And one way I put it, I distinguish moralism from morality. To be moralistic is not really to be moral. It's just the opposite. To be moralistic means you've closed your mind to try to consider what is right and wrong or good or an ethical way of living. Life is complicated, and when you try to oversimplify and say, well, here are the 10 or 15 things you should do or not do, that's not going to cover life decisions.
Right.
They're very complex. Like, for example, some of the medical issues, stem cell research and abortion, these are complicated, very difficult things to sort out. People, good people differ on them, but the conversation usually is between the extremes where people have not really explored the moral issues. They just latch on to a moralism. That is to say, well, this is right and that's wrong. It has to be for everybody because I think so. Well, that moralism is soulless. It works against the soul, and it keeps soul out of your life. So I find that issue to be very difficult. On the other hand, morality, you know, it's so important to be a moral person, and if you're living a soulful life, then if your soul is in a healthy position, you're going to not only know what you shouldn't do, but you're going to know what you should do, what you're called to do in your life in an ethical way. So, you know, maybe you're calling to get out there and volunteer and work for people who need help. It may be your calling to address the world in some way. I think morality is not just a negative thing, don't do this, don't do that. It's also a call to do something for the world community. And so morality is much richer, and I think has a lot more soul to it than moralism.
I agree with you entirely, and of course it enters our politics daily, and
really?
our thoughts of economy and all of that, everything. People seem to like to go from one side of the ring to the, you know, just go into their corners in the ring, and it's a duel rather than a, as President Johnson used to say, let's come together and decide or something like that. He had, and you know, and the intelligence coming out of the dialogue, which you remember Martin Buber's book, I think, The Miracle of Dialogue or something like that. So I think the truth of any kind of question, if you want to say it's the truth, comes out of that dynamic of, you know, let's find the truth here. Let's don't be too stuck in one way or the other. Let's find what works and what's practical for everybody and what they can agree on and how we, I don't know, I think there's an essential truth that goes on. We just have to find it.
Well, this is an interesting quality of soul, as I see it, is it appreciates diversity and multiplicity and variety, those kinds of things. Whereas when you're out of the soul, there's a tendency unconsciously to take sides and to always look for the only answer, you know, rather than to see that things are subtle and complicated. And it may take a long time to sort it all through. That capacity, the patience to sort through these issues with other people and respecting their opinions as you go is a very soulful thing to do. And we are lacking in that generally because almost anything we do in public life, people want to take sides and see who's right and who's wrong and polarize it.
So how can we expand and unite the various ways that we are, our spirits and minds and souls? How can we begin to unite ourselves or expand to bring balance into whatever we need? And we're also individual. How do we go about that? Do we read or do we, is it therapy or what would you say?
Well, you know, it does have to do with the community. One thing is education. People often come to that conclusion about questions like this. We don't educate people for soul. We educate for facts. We don't really enough, maybe we do it in some instances, but we don't do enough of teaching young people how to disagree, how to have a conversation, how to explore ideas and issues. We give kids facts, and then we test them on the facts and see if they know what we want them to learn. And we convince them that the whole point in education is to get a good job and to develop a skill to get a good job. Whereas even, 2,000 years ago, the Greeks knew that an educated person is someone who is able to be a thoughtful citizen in a society. I think that's a much better goal than what we've got today. So redoing education is a part of it. Now, when education fails, the institution of psychotherapy comes in because it's very similar to education, but it picks up the broken pieces. And so psychotherapy is a very important ingredient in our social life today because it does help in the extreme instances, especially to help people sort things out. But they should have done that long ago. About to give lectures at about two or three universities in the next month. And one of my messages will be that you can teach literature in a way where young people can sort out their lives through literature. You can teach any subject where there's more soul to it. It's not just facts, but it's an opportunity to become a more cultured person, a more aware person, a more self-aware person through almost any subject. So that's what I'm advocating. It's moving toward bringing more soul into education as one of the solutions.
Have you read much of Rudolf Steiner?
Well, yes. My children went to a Rudolf Steiner school for 10 years, so mm-hmm. I know that realm pretty well, and I appreciate much of it. We're very happy that they went to a Waldorf school for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read a lot of Steiner. Some of my colleagues have, but I haven't read a whole lot of him.
He was in touch with Carl Jung.
Yes.
They had some correspondence. I don't
yes.
think it was very long or
no.
deep, but they were in touch with each other.
Yes.
I know that Dennis Patrick Slattery and Jennifer Selleck are coming out with a new book on that very subject in education, learning.
Yes, I have a chapter on it, yeah.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes, Dennis is a good friend of mine.
Oh, yes, I look forward to that. He's going to be on this show in a couple
good.
Of weeks.
Oh, great.
I agree with you so much about the education for the soul. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but it's so important for ourselves as adults, as well as, of course, for our education and for a wider public understanding of that, as parents.
Well, I've had the experience in the past 3 years of teaching my daughter at home, high school. She's 17, and she developed an illness and just couldn't really handle the pressures, physical pressures of high school. She was doing very well, but it was not possible for her. So we decided to do homeschooling. And we just had our session this morning and enjoyed it immensely. I mean, she loves it, and I love it. She doesn't want to stop, even though she's getting her diploma this spring. She wants to ask me if we could have a summer session on mythology. Of course, she wants to read Joseph Campbell.
Oh, so, what a lucky girl she is.
So, there are things. I mean, I've learned so much from this experience. It's not an easy thing in some ways, but I know firsthand now there are ways to teach that that really do give a person sense of identity and culture.
Yes. Do you have all the videotapes of Joseph Campbell?
We have quite a few of them, yes. Uh-huh. We have a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful way to learn. It's a very,
it is.
Very painless.
This morning we watched that good classic film of Carl Rogers and Fritz Perls. Albert Ellis working with a patient in therapy.
Oh, yes.
So that was fun.
She was going to be so well-rounded, so beautifully well-rounded. It's really exciting.
She's doing well, yeah.
What a wonderful education. I think there should be a video or a movie about you.
Well,
there
I
should.
Don't,
it would be so interesting. Has that ever been, have you ever been approached?
No, I try to keep anything like that away from me if I can.
I'm a sort of closet screenwriter. In bringing ourselves together as human beings, and in you've talked in some of your books about community,
yeah,
and I think that's very important. And we're in a very growing, changing community here. We're going from apples and pears in our products to being the new wine country in Northern California. And the economy is kind of changing. And, of course, we're going through the problems that the whole country's going through, the whole world's going through economically. And so we're kind of struggling. But it is changing, like 8 or 10 little towns around a lake. And so logistics have been difficult in the past. And somehow we seem to be kind of overcoming that using internet. And somehow we're getting together better than we used to. And it's so rich to do that. It's such a wonderful experience for that to begin to happen when you see it various places. And I just wanted to talk with you a little bit about community.
What you're just saying now, the community is not going to change and mature unless, well, I've already said change, but it will not mature unless there are changes and they're painful and difficult. So I think, as I think President Obama understands this about the what we're going through economically, it is an opportunity, even though we have to deal with problems constantly, it is an opportunity to shift some of our values in the way we do things. And it's true of smaller communities or regions, you know, where you you can go through the experiences, you know, of difficulty and economic change and depression, and taking them as an opportunity to change. Because if everything's smooth going, we're not going to change. You know, we're just going to be unconsciously riding the wave. So this really is a time of opportunity, and I'm glad to hear that your community is taking advantage of it.
I saw on television this morning with Mr. Obama meeting with the Chinese premier, and he's going to China this year, and he seems so comfortable. He's expanding his own world, and I don't agree with everything he's done, but I do extremely respect the fact that he is putting on a demonstration of assertion out of active involvement. I'm supporting him in every way I can.
That's fantastic. Well, he's a remarkable person. I have rarely seen people in public life who seem so psychologically mature and able to handle themselves. And I think we need that more than we need technical leadership, actually.
I agree with you 100%. I worked in Washington for a long time in the press corps, and so I'm very interested in the presidential kinds of things. You have had a huge number of wonderful influences in your life. I was reading some of the notes in the back of Care of the Soul. One of them was, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, Paracelsus?
Paracelsus.
And he can be found in the Bollingen series of the, I guess, the Jungian books?
Yes, there are some Jungians have translated some of his works. There are several volumes of his works out. He's not easy to read. You know, he was writing in the 16th century.
Right.
But he was an alchemist and a physician. But you can find some real gems here and there. There's one place in particular I quote, maybe that's the one you're referring to, where he says that in medicine you can't even take a urine sample unless you know astrology and know the sky, you know, what's going on in the sky. I think that's really interesting that he would see medicine, treating the human body as connected to the world outside. We don't do that. We tend to just look with one focused eye on the body, and we don't even think about what's happening in the world around us.
I saw where he said, for example, to give heed, you quoted this, to give heed to the region in which the patient lives.
Yes, that's right.
From one country is different to another, and the earth is different, as are the stones, wines, bread, meat, everything that grows and thrives in a specific region. And he said a physician should be a cosmographer and a geographer, which I believe. I believe that entirely.
That's right.
I mean, where are we coming from? What is our, what's in our whole experience?
It's our whole experience. Right. We are, in a way, the expression of our place.
Right.
And if you don't take the place into account, then you really are not. You really don't know what your patient is, who is in front of you.
And then you wrote about, you've written and used Rilke in your writing.
Yes.
And talked about narcissism. And you also wrote in the book some interesting things about narcissism, and which is what we all suffer from a little bit, and some more than others. It was like a man is separated from his soul if he's too narcissistic, or a woman. And
well,
it has to do with self-love, you know, really a lack of self-love rather than too much love for self. Is that right?
That's right. I would see narcissism. I like your word, narcissism. It's really a good, really good way to describe what it is, because it is about narcissists, but it's making kind of getting a symptomatic way of getting into that. The story of Narcissus, the myth of Narcissus, is about a young man discovering who he is and softening up as a result. He starts out being compared to marble, and at the end of the story, he turns into a flower. The Narcissus flower. So that's a, that transformation that shows what goes on within us when we discover who we are. And if we don't make that discovery, we have to insist and display too much our search for ourselves. And so we begin to have an excessive focus on self simply because we can't find it. We don't have it. And the Narcissus myth then shows us that how important it is to find ourselves and become more relaxed as a result.
Thomas More, a conversation with you is a feast, and I just thank you so much. We've run into the end of our show. I didn't mean to do this. It just went away. The time went away.
It did.
I just thank you with all my heart for being here, and hope that we'll have an opportunity to talk again soon.
Well, I certainly do hope so, and thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. This is Tyra St. John with Inside Out. You've been listening to Thomas More, author of Care of the Soul and probably 25 more books, both those that have been published and those that are in the works right now. Stay tuned for Our Stories, Our Lives.